tirar algo. Deportista, te meto un ranarcado.
Congratulations.
Sì, una giacchetta anche del bere dei vai.
Mark's a rider who, well, he always entertains us. Some say he's also a bit sort of misunderstood. You obviously know him better than we all do. Just sketch a bit of a portrait of him as a guy and as a rider.
Yeah, I think definitely misunderstood is an understatement.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2024 Vuelta a España from Lisboa to Madrid.
Buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes, ¿qué tal?
Who's that?
Soy yo.
Rob Hatch. Rob Hatch. Yours was not the first voice we heard today, the first voice we heard. But we had voices on the way up the climb. Fans greeting you with, well, a rapturous reception at the Vuelta a España. They were waiting for the Vuelta a España, of course. Rob, we then heard Jay Vine's voice, Jay Vine's cries of jubilation when he congratulated his mate, teammate, Marc Soler, just spoiled the result of today's stage. And then finally, we heard Marc Soler saying that Jay Vine was misunderstood.
No, that was
a very misunderstood. I don't know if the listeners will have heard it, but talking of misunderstandings, Rob, just tell us what's just happened.
Well,
what happened half an hour ago? So, go back in time a bit and tell us what happened about half an hour ago.
A bit longer than that, wasn't it? Red jersey, again, spoiler alert, is Ben O'Connor. He has just returned to the podium here. It's raining outside. It's Urbayando. I'll explain that later in the episode. It's raining outside, that fine rain that soaks you through. And he just stormed out of the podium, shouted that he was effing freezing.
He was slightly unhappy. But explain, let's piece this together, Rob. Explain what happened when Ben O'Connor, we were there, we were standing next to him. What happened when he came over the line, having saved the red jersey, another spoiler, by how many seconds was it?
Five.
What happened?
He didn't seem very happy. I was wondering at first whether he's unhappy with his own performance because he lost, you know, a good part of a minute, didn't he?
We knew he'd kept the jersey.
We knew he'd kept the jersey, but Daniel, we kept quiet because I think we were both worrying that we'd made a miscalculation. We hadn't, as Sean Kelly always likes to say, made the calculation correctly. We were looking up at the big screen. It was chaos up there, wasn't it? It was an absolute disaster. It's my first day on the Vuelta. I don't know what I've done to bring this. So I can completely understand why O'Connor is unhappy now, because after that situation at the top there, he was shaking his head. He went back down to the buses, Daniel, all the way down the climb.
His body language seemed inconsistent with someone who had just, in a miraculous sort of rear guard effort, particularly in the last couple of kilometres, had saved the red jersey in the Vuelta a España. And, well, as we've sort of hinted already, you and I were about to say something because we sensed that there might have been a misunderstanding. Adding to the misunderstanding, a couple of minutes later, or after he'd gone, I heard his soigneur. Well, in fact, we've got the audio. Listen to
this. We need to listen to it back.
So that was Decathlon, one of Decathlon's soigneurs, telling Valentin Paris-Peintre, in French, of course, that Ben had kept the jersey by 5 seconds.
Are we sure he said kept? Well, I mean,
yeah, he did. So I can't remember whether you've explained this already, Rob, but Ben O'Connor had to ride all the way down the mountain, bypassing the podium presentation.
15 kilometres, that is, down the mountain.
15 kilometres, and, well, that was about, I don't know, 45 minutes ago, an hour ago. The podium presentation has just happened. We think we're waiting behind it, but Ben O'Connor has lost an hour of his evening, or 45 minutes, an hour of his evening. And that is obviously not what you want when you're trying to defend the leadership of a major tour.
And not in these conditions as well, because it's hard to relay how horrible the weather is up here. It's been spitting since we've been here this afternoon. It's got gradually worse. It's cold. I mean, I've got two jackets and a t-shirt on. I'm cold. I've got cold feet. You know, just imagine what these guys are like after the thousands and thousands of kilojoule days that they've had. The temperatures up and down the mountains. There's been some nasty crashes that we'll hear about as well. All sorts has gone on today, and and there was a huge bit of confusion at the top, like we said. Say, we'll go into what happened. Maybe I think the organisation, maybe the Spaniard could have done a better job. Nobody stopped him. And again, it's not really Ben O'Connor's fault, and I can understand why he's angry. But as we've just seen, he is angry.
I tell you what, Rob, he was in a better mood this morning when we spoke to him. We spoke to him about the stage that was going to be to the Lagos de Covadonga. A couple of days ago, we had this discussion about what kind of stage would suit Ben O'Connor as opposed to Primoz Roglic. These big kilojoule days when the race was sort of on full gas from the gun. The consensus seemed to be in the peloton that was the recipe, possibly, for a Roglic undoing. We explored that theme a bit more this morning with Ben O'Connor and George Bennett. And, well, this was before you and I spent 5 minutes talking about cricket with Ben O'Connor. Just as he was about to start stage, as I said, he was in a better mood this morning. Here he is, followed by George Bennett. Everyone seems to be cottoning on to the fact that Primoz doesn't necessarily like a hard, well, day all day, hard, a high pace all day on these big kilojoule stages. Does it still feel like a bit of a leap of faith to say we as Decathlon are going to make it hard all day for that purpose?
Yeah, I think. You can say that, but in the end, he's won La Vuelta, what, three times? Or was it four times?
Three.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm sure he's had many a hard day, and he's gone through many a hard day and still won the race. So, and it's one of those ones as well where you can look a bit like a fool if you do that, and then he crushes you at the end still.
You don't have social media anymore, so you don't care.
Exactly. So there's no hard feelings. As soon as, if I do anything wrong, I never see it. But, yeah. I think it's something to be aware of because you never like to lose a race from your own mistake.
What a wonderful way to live. No social media in your life.
I mean, I still have Instagram, but it's a different kind of story.
Again, we've talked about this, that Primoz maybe doesn't like those sort of big kilojoule days as much. It seems to me that that's common. That's not something that people have learned in this world, is it? That's common knowledge, and it has been for a long time.
Yeah, I think they're really hitting... It's really coming home, though, like how... Maybe, I think people did know that, but I think people also are now learning that like a guy like Ben is really good after a super long hard day without big peaks. He can't do, you know, he can't do 6.5 watts a kilo for 30 minutes, but he can do 6 at the end of a hard day. And I think like I think people have really learned how to, in the last sort of couple of mountain stages, how to take time out of him.
So Rob, that was Ben O'Connor first, George Bennett second, talking about this morning. And as this very unusual, very curious postscript continues to play out, well, it's just played out, I think, fully, and we have an answer now as to exactly what happened, exactly the nature of the misunderstanding which led to Ben O'Connor going AWOL for about an hour. All will be revealed in just a few moments, but before that, I guess it's time for us to go inside and, well, to fill you in with the tale of the etapa.
El resumen de la etapa. The tale of the etapa.
So, stage 16 of the Vuelta a España. Luanco to the Lagos de Covadonga. 181.5 kilometers. Usually we give the total elevation on the day's stage. Don't have that to hand.
About 3,500, I think 3,800 might
sound
ring a bell.
About right, Rob. Rob, four climbs on the route. Tell us what they were.
Four climbs on the route. They were very, very good ones. I'm trying to bring them up straight
climbs
in front of me.
Wasn't
now. Yeah, they're very good climbs. I know that we started with the Mirador del Fito. There are actually three climbs on the route, Daniel. Three classified climbs, but having ridden the area quite extensively recently, I know that there's plenty of unclassified climbing as well.
You're
the classified climbs were Mirador del Fito, Collada Llomena, and Lagos de Covadonga, of course, Categoría Especial.
A stage that bore more than a striking resemblance to a day that will remain in the heart of Primoz Roglic, because he struck out, didn't he, on the Llomena in 2021. Probably the most impressive sort of solo performance of Primoz Roglic's career. That sort of wrapped up victory in the 2021 Vuelta a España. Excuse the noise. Everything's being dismantled all around us. Rob, two DNSs today. Tom Pacour, who we think should be pronounced in the French way, of Intermarché, and Callum Scotson of Jayco Alula, Should also remind you of the general classification going into today's stage. Of course, Ben O'Connor still led by 1 minute and 3 seconds after that 20-second time penalty for Primoz Roglic on Sunday, which incidentally yesterday in his press conference said, well, was due to his own mistake, his team's mistake. They should never have tried to change the bike on Sunday. It was folly, and it cost him 20 seconds. Third, Enric Mas, 2 minutes 23 down. Carapaz, 2:44. And Landa, 3:05. We'll stop the rundown of the GC there. And we'll get on to the action. Lots of attacks from the gun. We've got a group of 15 eventually with Jay Vine, Isaac Del Toro and Marc Soler of UAE. Rob, were they also blocking behind? Were they the ones that ensured that break stayed away? We'll give some more names in just a second.
It was a combination of three or four different things. Just one of those moments, Daniel, they were climbing out of Gijón onto a bit of sort of lumpy road, very close to the coast. Narrow roads, easier to block, and I just think everybody was happy with it, really.
Some more names, William Lecerf Jr., Marco Frigo, Matthew Riccitello, as he likes to be called, Darren Rafferty of EF Education Easy Purse, Oyer Lascano of Movistar, Mihalovic of Bahrain Victorious, Engelhardt of Jayco, Alula Zana of Jayco Alula, Guglielmi of Arkea, Poul of DSM, Firmenich Post NL, and Tussfeldt of the same team. And they were joined by two counter-attackers, Sylvain Munique of Lotto Destiny and Jon Izagirre of Cofidis. They made good progress with 150 kilometers to go. Their gap was already 1 minute 30 seconds. Rob?
It then really started to balloon, though. They got down to Villaviciosa, where they were sort of starting to climb again after that. They worked on it, and of course, a combination of what was happening behind. It ballooned out to as many at one stage as 10 minutes.
Do you know what, Rob? I've already made the first clamoroso of the tail of the etapa, because I haven't mentioned the most important, the biggest name in there, the biggest beast, Wout van Aert. He was in the green jersey, of course. And over the first climb of the day, the Mirador del Fito, was it the first climb of the day?
It was the first main climb of the day.
He extended his lead in the King of the Mountains competition.
It's probably worth mentioning at this point as well that the reason why everybody was so happy behind, because the closest man in the general classification was Riccitello, wasn't he? And I say closest in a very loose use of the term, because he was just over an hour behind the race leader.
Rob, things got considerably faster as both groups, both the peloton and the breakaway group, came towards the Collado Yomena with around 60 kilometers to go. The gap at that point was 8 minutes and 30 seconds to the main peloton.
And Movistar really took it up then, didn't they? They really started to light the fire, and we, I think, turned away for a couple of minutes. We'd moved up to the top of the climb, hadn't we, driven up, and we suddenly looked up at the telly and things were really happening. And then, after a lot of work from Movistar, a little bit from EF2 as they tried to position Carapaz at the bottom of the Collada Yomena, we heard a big roar in the press room, didn't we? And that was from the Spanish journalists, because I think we saw
some
the biggest attack.
Chauvinistic or patriotic.
Maybe a bit
Spanish
of
Spanish journalists. We had two big cheers in the press room, didn't we, today? We had one when Mikel Landa attacked on the Yomena climb, and one when, well, Enric Mas's attack came first, didn't it?
It did. Maybe the biggest attack we've ever seen from Enric Mas.
Yeah. That one burned brightly, but, well, it didn't. It was a bit of a candle in the wind, wasn't it, Rob? And didn't last very long. Roglic was quickly across, marking him out, and Landa opened up more daylight, shall we say, but his was also a relatively short-lived effort, because Valentin Paris-Peintre of Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale was on policeman duty for Ben O'Connor, and he soon snuffed that one out as well. In the breakaway, Wout van Aert went over the summit of the Yomena first. Jay Vine had been doing a lot of pulling on the climb itself, and then, Rob, Disaster for Wout van Aert, disaster for the race. What happened?
There was a very, very nasty crash. Engelhardt, Del Toro, and crucially Wout van Aert crashed. And Wout van Aert looked in a real mess, didn't he? He had a big gash on his right knee. He tried to get up. He was very slow to get up, understandably, when you could see what the problem was. He had one of those big, horrible golf balls on his right arm and elbow as well. And more worryingly, it looked like he was about to faint. He was sitting sort of on the edge of the boot of the car. Addy Engel, sports director, and a mechanic was with him. The doctor came to treat him, and they quickly got his helmet off. It didn't look good. And we sort of knew at that point that, unfortunately, the leader of both the points classification and, as you just described, an increased lead in the King of the Mountains classification, Fanart was going to have to leave the race. It took a while before the official confirmation came through, but Wout Fanart at that point was out the race.
We wondered, Rob, how this would impact the progress of the breakaway, but the gap was still a healthy one above, well, it was over 6 minutes, wasn't it? And they came into the bottom of the Lagos de Covadonga climb, around 15 kilometres, no, 12.2 kilometres, in fact, the Covadonga climb, with, well, several riders still in contention. The first significant attacks we saw, Filippo Zana was on the move early on, as was Max Poole. And those two were able to detach themselves. They were joined with 7 kilometres to go, just when the steep part of the Covadonga climb, referred to as La Husera, began. Marc Soler made it back to that duo, those two men at the front. Rob, should we tell people what was the denouement in the breakaway group, and then we'll go back to the GC group?
I think we should do, because it was Marc Soler here, and at this point you're thinking Marc Soler is being Marc Soler again. He came back, and once again, a little bit later up the climb, he decided to attack, didn't he? This time, they were going to struggle to get him back, because he had around 25 seconds coming up into the final couple of kilometres. That went down to 20 seconds, but Marc Soler this time was able to bring it home. A couple of little descents on the way in, isn't there? And he came up to the top, and he wouldn't have seen the finish line until about 3 or 4 metres before he crossed it, because it was misty, it was horrible, it was cold. But it was one of those wonderful wins that he pulled off, and yet again a stage win at the Vuelta.
The much misunderstood Marc Soler, as we heard Jay Vine say at the start of tonight's podcast. More about that and about Marc Soler in just a moment. But Rob, we said that Soler had made it back with about 7 kilometres to go. That was around about the point on the climb when Mikel Landa unleashed his next sort of round of attacks.
And he looked great, didn't he? It was Landani. He was down in the drops. He was looking around. He could see a gap. And this time it did seem to open up. But again, it was never really more than, what, 10, 15 seconds. As I think it was Pache Patre who was still trying to save the day behind.
And this was a part of the climb where we first saw Ben O'Connor in the red jersey starting to struggle. Mm. Indeed, with 5.6 kilometres to go, approximately, we really saw him, well, he was losing ground and slipping back and losing touch with the front group. We think Enric Mas accelerated at this point, and a quartet were able to detach themselves eventually, weren't they, Rob? It was Mas, Carapaz, Roglic, and the rider who I've been referring to over the last few days as Salt Bay, due to David Gourdou's striking resemblance.
I think you need to see him without a helmet on, don't you?
Yeah, to a self-aggrandizing, steak-slicing social media star. And that was pretty much how it remained, was it not, Rob? There were no capitulations behind them. Everyone was pretty much where they have been on big mountain stages, whether it be Skelmoser, whether it be Sugarman, Carlos Rodriguez.
One maybe little bit of a difference there, because you mentioned Sugarman there. Sugarman's back in the white jersey because Florian Lipovic did lose a little bit of time behind. So that was the only sort of change in order behind there. Everybody was where they were. And obviously, Ben O'Connor was behind, wasn't he, in trouble at this point. And the gap to him was growing. It grew to a point. It was hovering around a minute. And of course, he started the day, you reminded us, what was it, 1:03 in front. And at this point, with a few Ks to go, you think he's going to lose the jersey. But there were a few more twists and turns there.
There were, Rob. But I think the rest of the stage and what happened with the GC group is probably best rendered, best described, really, by the final standings of the stage. Maybe, Rob, you would like to tell us. Well, we know that Marc Soler won the stage. Who came in next? And where were all those GC chaps?
Well, the GC chaps weren't far behind. They weren't far behind at all, as we struggle to just make sure we get the standings up in front of us again. Soler, Zana, Paul, you mentioned. Jay Vine was next, a very happy Jay Vine, and we'll hear from him, as you said. Yonis Aguirre, there was Isaac Del Toro as well, another one who came straight over to the UAE scrum in all of the chaos at the top to say congratulations to Soler. Marco Frigo behind, Ricky Tello, and then Mas Carapaz, Roglic crossing the line, 3 minutes 54 seconds after the winner. We were all doing the back of the cigarette packet maths, weren't we, at the top, whilst trying to see if we could get a little bit of a reaction from
Salt,
those who
Salt
won.
Salt Bae had slipped back slightly.
Salt Bae was... I can't believe you got me saying that. I tell you what, commentary's going to be interesting, isn't it, next time I'm back on? I mean, I know it might be boring for a lot of you anyway, but dearie me, we're going to get some interesting names. Skelmoser and Godu, that is the aforementioned restaurateur, he was a good 6 or 7 seconds back. Then it was Rodriguez and Landa, another 9 seconds after the main group of Mas Carapaz and Roglic, who were continuing to count down. Kuss came down a few seconds back. Then it was Adam Yates, who was around 3/4 of a minute back with Florian Lipovic. And then, 58 seconds later, in the red jersey, absolutely exhausted, shaking his head. We wondered at the time, as you'd already heard, had he lost the jersey? Had he thought he'd lost the jersey? We were convinced he'd kept it, had he had, Daniel. Ben O'Connor still leads the Vuelta a España by 5 single seconds.
5 single seconds, which meant that, yes, he did have to make his way back up the mountain to the podium.
With a police escort.
Yeah, for the red jersey presentation. He wasn't best pleased, as we have already established. We're going to hear from Ben O'Connor now, and, well, he's going to make no secret of the fact that he wasn't thrilled. Rob, when we hear from another couple of riders, I'll tell you who they are in a second, in part two, we're going to explain, we had a final off-mic, a definitive explanation from Ben O'Connor as to exactly the mechanics of what went wrong after the finish, and where indeed he'd got to and why. So, Ben O'Connor first. We are then going to hear from Jay Vine. That's the rest of the interview we teased in the intro. And he was talking about his teammate Marc Soler as a stage winner being misunderstood. And then finally, we're going to hear from the unlucky again, one of the unlucky defeated men in today's stage, the Lagos de Covadonga. He now has a third place, a second place, and a third place. Surely a matter of time before Max Poole opens his Grand Tour account. So, O'Connor first, then Vine, then Poole.
Well, I was told I was told to descend down to the bottom, and yeah, I descended all the way down the mountain, and then was told that actually you've got to come back up. So that was a bit frustrating, to be honest.
But at the same time, big news, because you are still in the red jersey with 5 seconds over Primoz Roglic.
Yeah, I guess so. Although I could definitely do with a hot shower, to be honest. I'm absolutely freezing. But I have the red jersey for tomorrow, so I'll try and soak it up and enjoy it as much as I can, because I'm not sure it'll last that long.
How was it today, this climb to Lagos de Covadonga?
Hard. I actually thought I didn't have any power today. I had no idea what I was doing, but I felt actually pretty strong, to be honest. But clearly it's not strong enough.
What does this mean, Ben? 5 seconds that you have on Primoz Roglic now. Are you? Do you think you can keep it now? What's your feelings with 5 seconds?
I'll probably keep it tomorrow, maybe the day after. I'd be surprised on Friday, but in the end it's been a pretty good tenure with the red jersey so far. It's what, 11 days now, so hopefully I can have it for a couple more and try and maximize it to the best I can.
What'd you say to your teammate Peter Bentre when you were up there at the finish line, because you look pretty depleted?
Yeah, I was pretty worn. He was grateful. He actually was really, really strong today, and I'm also grateful for him to be back like he was in the Giro. So I think everyone in our team is super proud. You know, it's been an experience that we really haven't had before. So to have 11 days in the red jersey already so far is a pretty sweet experience for us all.
So even with all this, you're still happy you have the red jersey, even with going down the mountain and coming back up?
I'm not happy, I can tell you that. I'm trying to put on a brave face, but yeah, internally, I'm a bit pissed.
Thank you, Ben.
Got again. Solid.
Like, yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, Max Soler's not a he's not an easy guy to follow. Lots of changes of pace, and just tell us what were you hoping was going to happen on that final climb? What was the sort of film that you had in your head?
I felt pretty good. And in the bottom, I had the feeling like, there's still teams with two good options. And yeah, I felt like they were playing around a bit, but kind of sandbagging. And in the end, I thought it was best to get in front, and I didn't have to deal with too many changes in pace. Could do my race. And yeah, Soler came across, and I thought he looked like he was struggling, but I think it's just him. And I was trying to get him to come through. He didn't want to come through. I think he had Del Toro behind. But yeah, I thought maybe he's trying to recover a bit, so just keep a bit of pace. I didn't feel like I was hurting myself too much, and yeah, in the end, he just wore me down, and yeah, I was completely done by the finish.
You've had a few of these near misses now. Are you just telling yourself that if you keep trying, if you keep going, one day it's gonna turn right?
Yeah, you know, I have it in me. I feel good. So for sure, you know, I have it in me. But yeah, I think just keep getting the confidence in these results, and again, just some experience to know how to race different scenarios. So yeah, hopefully I can get one. We'll see. There's a few more opportunities maybe, and yeah, I hope I can. Yeah, the last descent was super dangerous. It was like mud and slippy, and yeah, obviously them three guys crashed. Hope they're not too bad. And yeah, it was really random actually. It looked fine in the corner, and then they just completely wiped out. So yeah, the descents are tricky, climbs hard, and yeah, in the final week of what's already been a super hard race, is for sure everybody's feeling it.
Yeah, it's actually bizarre because, you know, we took the, for cyclists, we're not that bright, so we took the first part of the technical descent really, really cautiously, and, you know, we sort of thought it was over, and then there was this wet patch through a left-hander, and I think I was like fifth or sixth in the group, and the first three guys all hit the deck. So, yeah, you know, hope he's okay. Unfortunate because he was kicking my ass in all the sprints at the top of these climbs. There's nothing I could do. But also, without emptying myself completely and possibly not getting a win, you know, that was in the end, the team win was the goal. And you know, the jerseys are bonus.
Jay, Mark's a rider who, well, he always entertains us. Someone says he's also a bit sort of misunderstood. You obviously know him better than we all do. Just sketch a bit of a portrait of him as a guy and as a rider.
Yeah, I think definitely misunderstood is an understatement. I don't think he's as selfish as people like to play him up to be. There's always a tactic from the car behind what he's doing. You know, we tried to explode the race the other day in GC wise with getting multiple guys up the road. You know, he's always willing to pull. You know, he's always willing to work his ass off, and it's just really great to, you know, to learn from him. And you know, he's been in the sport longer than me, he's given me a lot of advice. He's ridden for me a couple of times this race even, and it's really great to be able to help him.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here at Podcast HQ to tell you that this episode is sponsored by AG1. Now, we're entering the final week of the 2024 Grand Tour season, and it's important to keep the energy levels up for that final push to Madrid. I'm sure that Daniel is feeling reinvigorated by the arrival of Rob Hatch there in Spain. A much needed injection of, let's just say some fresh legs, put it that way, shall we, for the final stages to Madrid. A fresh voice to help see Daniel home Another way to feel your best and keep feeling fresh and invigorated is AG1, which is a blend of more than 70 high-quality ingredients, including vitamins, minerals, and other good stuff to help replace and indeed better your morning multivitamin supplement. It's not only a better way to take on board some much-needed nutrition, it's also a more enjoyable experience because one scoop of AG1 mixed with water makes a very pleasant drink that feels refreshing to drink. I make sure I have mine in the morning before I head over to the coffee machine, and it feels like a healthy start to the day because AG1 can help to boost your immune system, improve your focus and energy levels, and generally make you feel like the best version of yourself. So if you want to replace your multivitamins and more, start with AG1 today. You can try AG1 and get yourself a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription. Go to drinkag1.com/cycling. That's drinkag1.com/cycling.
Well, Rob, as we try to piece together the, well, I've already referred to them as misunderstandings that occurred after the finish, and well, you and I have been, we'll be recording behind the podium, we're recording next to the press room. And first of all, we should just establish, and people have probably already noticed, slightly different audio quality since we moved from a slightly less ad hoc setup, because we were sort of on the fly. It was kind of guerrilla podcasting. Just explain now where we are.
We are in a big bus shelter in a car park.
It's very Lancashire.
It's in bus shelter in car park. We're in North anyway, so I can talk like this, can't I now? We're in a very big bus shelter in a car park. Posh voices back for you now, Daniel. And it's still Urbayano, it's still drizzling, which is
We didn't explain what that was.
Well, Urbayu, it's a part of the Asturian identity. And I think you've probably already established in a few podcasts that I spend quite a bit of time up here nowadays. My partner's from Gijón. Well, we're actually from Arion, that's where the race passed through, but she lives in Gijón nowadays.
You're not goading rival football fans.
I was actually, yes.
On the climb. As we drove up the climb, who were Gijón's big rivals?
So
were you?
There was an Oviedo shirt, which is the blue. That's Santi
Cazorla's
team, by the way.
Yes, it is.
And my other half is a big Sporting fan, so I was having a bit of a laugh and a joke.
The tippy tappy Asturian drizzle.
Yes, drizzle. Basically, if you go through Asturias, motorways, sides of houses, you see there's a lot of graffiti in Spain, isn't there? Anyway, you see this word graffitied everywhere, and Urbayu is the Asturian word for light drizzle, and it describes, I suppose, even if you've never been here,
is that really edgy in Asturias to spray paint the word light drizzle?
I've asked the question a few times as to why it's graffitied, and again, for those of you who don't know, I've lived on and off in Spain for more than half my life now, so I know the whole sort of, you know, graffiti thing. It's never really an edgy thing in other regions to put words for light drizzle on the side of the road.
There are lots of, I presume there are lots of words describing weather phenomena that are seen as particularly typical of a particular region. We talked in the car, Rob, about the fact that the Basques also have a word for something very similar, sirimiri. Which sounded a lot like your tippy-tappy light drizzle.
Yeah, and the tippy-tappy light drizzle, I guess it's so important to people because it explains why this is a very different-looking part of Spain. It's very green, it's very mountainous like the rest of Spain if you go down south, you know. Very mountainous country, but it's often mountainous and barren and bare, isn't it? But this is green, it looks different, it feels different. And yes, back to where we were, we're sat in a bus stop, it's Urbayando. And I can just about... The visibility's got better in the last half an hour. Well, I wasn't going to say last half an hour since the stage finished, but it's probably a couple of hours since the stage finished now, seeing as what we've just seen happen.
Welcome back to the weather podcast.
Yes.
For coming to you from the weather Spain. Rob, after that interview we just heard with Ben O'Connor, he did explain to us off mic exactly what did occur. And in fact, we'd misunderstood the misunderstanding.
Yes.
What did he tell us?
He told us that he knew... He still had the jersey, but obviously he wasn't elated with his performance, as you heard in the interview as well. But it was nice to see him because he was a little bit more relaxed. I think he'd had some nice warm clothes on. He still wanted to get some food into him, understandably, but and obviously not happy being where he was. But he thought that the podium was down the bottom. Mm. He'd been told to go down the bottom by somebody, so it certainly wasn't Ben O'Connor's fault. And you, having seen him again in that relaxed light, I really felt for him, actually, because it's been a bad enough, nasty enough day for him anyway, losing the best part of a minute, knowing, as he's already told us, that he thinks he might lose the jersey in the next few days. And he still had to come up and accept the jersey and smile and do his bit and still be here and be freezing cold.
Talk to us schmucks.
Yeah.
We still do have a couple of doubts. A couple of things still need to be explained. Like, for example, where were the chaperones, the anti-doping chaperones?
Well, it's worth explaining that it was complete chaos up there, anyway, wasn't it? It was a disaster. Yeah. It's a while since I've been to a race.
Did you see any chaperones up there?
I saw a couple, okay. But they weren't with Ben O'Connor, no.
To the racing, I suppose, Rob. And unfortunately, all of that confusion after the finish, they sort of obscured, overshadowed what had been a brilliant performance by him. You mentioned it, that at one stage he looked as though he might be in free fall. We've already heard in the interview he didn't necessarily... Well, I think when he said, "I didn't have any power," I think he was referring to the fact that his head unit wasn't working. Or maybe that had gone AWOL as well. I don't think he was referring to how he felt his legs. I also noticed that he'd ripped out his earpiece on the final climb. I haven't noticed whether that's a common thing with him. But it was, by all accounts, a brilliant performance. And a brilliant performance also by his team, by Valentin Paris-Peintre, who was worth his weight in gold today, in the absence of Félix Gall, who we spoke to this morning, and explained that he wasn't ill the other day when he completely capitulated on Sunday. It was just one of those days where he felt as though he had nothing in his legs. I asked him this morning whether he thought that he could bounce back, whether he had experience of this kind of thing, and whether he had indeed bounced back when this had happened in the past, and he said, "Well, I don't know," and he sounded doubtful, to be honest. And we didn't see Félix Gall at the business end of the race today. But Paris-Peintre was worth his weight in gold, wasn't he?
No, he was sensational. He did a lot of riding when not really any other big name rider had any teammates around. He was the last surviving teammate, really, from sort of first recollection, thinking back and watching up the big screen. Very different for me, actually. It's a different experience for me to be up there watching the big screen rather than having to talk about every happening. I know that I don't think I've got quite as much registered in the head, so I apologise if I do miss it, but from first recollection, I think he was the only remaining teammate for anybody there, apart from people dropping back from the breakaway.
So, Rob, the question is, where does it leave us? We heard Ben there say that he expects to maybe keep the jersey another couple of days until the next, the first of two remaining big mountain stages, and then, of course, we've got the time trial as well. But that margin of 5 seconds now, I mean, Primoz Roglic might be pretty happy with that outcome. I mean, as we watched it, as we were standing watching on the big screen, I almost sort of facetiously suggested that he might want to pump the brakes a little bit to ensure that Ben O'Connor did keep the jersey.
Well, with all that happened, I'd love to know the time exactly that Primoz Roglic should have a step under the warm shower, was able to sit in his nice comfy seat on the bus, and compare that to Ben O'Connor, who of course was on the bus earlier, maybe, but was quickly removed from it, and goodness knows what time he felt warm water over his head, and goodness knows when he's going to get the massage. Also, with food at the hotel, getting down this with all the traffic as well. Very different experience in the evening now for first and second.
Rob, did we see anything from Enric Mas in particular to suggest that Primoz Roglic might have sleepless nights ahead of him? I mean, my feeling is that he definitely took a big step closer towards this fourth Vuelta victory today. Okay, it wasn't as emphatic as the last time we came to Lagos de Covadonga. I think that was stage 17 in 2021, and it really was signed, sealed, delivered at the end of that day. That's not the case now. And there were times, I think it was more Landa that really looked as though he would pose a threat. He could sort of precipitate a Roglic, not necessarily collapse, but difficulty, some kind of minor mini crisis. But did we see enough from Mas to suggest that maybe looking ahead to Picon Blanco, and we heard earlier from Ben O'Connor and George Bennett on this theme that's developed about Roglic maybe not enjoying, not sort of digesting the multi-mountain stages as well. Did we see anything from Mas to suggest that Rog should be quaking?
Quaking, definitely not. Mm. With a thought in the back of his mind, yes. A minute and 20 between Roglic and Mas. I was listening to Eina Rubio chat to our Colombian colleagues at the line. They're obviously very confident, and I'm obviously aware of the fact that he has to say the right things, especially when the very enthusiastic, equally patriotic and maybe chauvinistic sometimes Colombian media, where there's you were talking about the Spaniards. But, you know, he has to say the right things. He was saying all the right things. We're still confident. We feel good. I'm feeling better. Naido's feeling better. That sort of stuff. Looking ahead, tomorrow's not an opportunity on paper, unless something bizarre happens in the race. I don't think there's going to be any wind about or anything like that, even though we're in quite a possibly windy part of Spain tomorrow, trailing around the coast, lots of twists and turns. You've got a strange stage tomorrow, haven't you, that probably should end in a sprint, but you don't know. You look to the next couple of days, you've got up and down in the natural park in Izki in the Basque Country. Then we go to Moncalvillo, I think, which is in the Rioja. Anyway, we start in the Rioja in Logroño. That's a big climb in the middle of the stage.
Where
longer
Roglic
stage.
Has won before.
Roglic knows, as you said, big climb at the end as well. But the day after that, if it is to be made one of those ridiculously hard days, that is the day. And if you look at Movistar's team, if they were going to do something crazy, that would be the day, wouldn't it? Get some riders up the road, Quintana to play a big role, Rubio, the people like that. Can Lazcano find it in himself to do something at some point, although there's not real terrain, maybe apart from helping to launch those satellite riders at the start. And then obviously if you can do that on stage 20, you're also going to maybe blunt the weapon that Roglic has on the final day, both morally and physically, with the time trial. So you would think, of course, with the time trial on the final day anyway, it's not just a 1:20, is it? Mass needs a buffer going into that final day. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that something happens, but I think it's still a difficult ask for Enric Mass.
Yeah, Enric Mass needs a huge buffer. I would also say that with the exception of La Planche des Belles Filles, we've rarely seen a Primoz Roglic capitulation. A complete capitulation. Okay, in the Dauphiné, I mean, he's often given us nervous moments. I've talked repeatedly in this world about the concept of the Rogler coaster, and there will be nervous moments between now and Madrid, I'm sure. But we've very rarely seen him lose 2, 3, 4 minutes on a mountain stage, and that is probably what he would have to lose. Bearing in mind Enric Mas's performances against the clock in the past, I mean, you look at those three guys, Carapaz, they're the three, really. If you take O'Connor out of the equation, which I don't think we should necessarily do, but Mas, Carapaz, and Landa, they're not just average time trialists, they're poor time trialists historically. Although, if you go back to Mas's quick step days, he actually used to do pretty good time trials, but he's somehow forgotten how to ride good time trials since he joined Movistar. Just on Movistar, Rob, I look at those names. Mas, Carapaz, Landa, the mythical, the tritico in Italian, did those three ever make up the trident at Movistar? Were they there at the same time?
Carapaz, Landa.
I'm not sure.
No. Carapaz was there at the same time.
Mas was a replacement for one of the others, wasn't he? Anyway, Rob, what I was going to say, and I don't like these storylines, and I think sometimes my colleagues, fellow journalists in the Mixzone press room, they sort of pull these narratives by their hair and try to kind of shoehorn them into the narrative of a Grand Tour. The alliance, the theory of the alliance. Who knows? Did we see some evidence of one today? Was Mikel Landa attacking, then Mas going? Was that evidence of maybe them sort of deciding to alternate and kind of take pot shots one by one at Roglic?
Do you think they've got a WhatsApp group going?
Well, yeah, mate, I want to be on it. If they have, I bet it'd be a cracking read.
But nobody's left the group anyway after
today,
have
but
they?
But that is one theory. Maybe we will dig into this because, I mean, we've just struggled to remember whether they were all together at Movistar at the same time. With those three names, I look at those three names, and particularly in the case of Carapaz and Mas, there's a lot of history, agents as well. There have been periods in the recent history of Movistar when there have been a lot of politics in terms of who they sign, who's their leader, whether one rider likes another rider. So maybe tomorrow we'll stir the pot and we'll look at that and we will extrapolate and exaggerate and embellish and convince people that Primoz Roglic is going to face an unholy or holy, depending on whether you're a Carapaz fan or a Roglic fan, Hispanic alliance.
Well, just down the road, I mentioned my partner comes from down the road. She's got a summer house down there. Maybe we'll stop in the kitchen on the way back, get a big wooden spoon and take it to the start tomorrow, shall we?
Let's do that. Rob, we should talk about the stage winner, Marc Soler.
Yes,
but
we
before
should,
yeah. we do, we should talk about another rider who was in that breakaway group, Wout van Aert, who very sadly crashed out of the Vuelta a España. After a brilliant Vuelta a España, I think he would have, I mean, looking at tomorrow's profile, it would have been a perfect stage for him. It's the sort of profile that reminded me, brought to my mind, vintage era Peter Sagan, when Liquigas would work all day and they would drop every other sprinter on the, well, there are two difficult climbs tomorrow, but in the middle of the stage. It's a very strange profile, but in my mind's eye, I could already see maybe Visma, especially with Sepkus not having had a brilliant day today, maybe Visma sort of committing everything to another Wout van Aert victory tomorrow. And alas, it's not going to happen.
It isn't, no. And again, you go back to the point that has been one of the big recurring themes in the storyline of the season through every single race we've been at. Visma Lisa bike, their lack of luck. It's been worse than that, hasn't it, really? Too much has happened just to call it bad luck. I think it's been an absolute shocker on that front for them. And you really feel for them. And spending time, I've been lucky enough to work a little bit with Nathan Verheudonk this year at Eurosport. And just spending time on and off, Mike, hearing about the difficulties and how hard it's been mentally and physically to come back, and stories of just weeks after, even being out of breath following those sort of punctured lungs and things like that, both riders walking across the car park and walking to the restaurant where they were meeting and things like that. It's been a really hard road back, so I really feel, because Van Aert, he's down for the European Championships, up against his big rival Mathieu van der Poel, he's down for the World Championships, and the way he's been riding as well, you could have thought, well, you know, is he going better than Evenepoel, who've obviously been fantastic in the first half of the season, but just starting to build up now for the Worlds as well. It could have been really well Van Aert's moment, couldn't it, for the World Championships?
It could indeed, Rob. Unfortunately, he is leaving the Vuelta a España. He's also left the King of the Mountains jersey. He did leave it vacant, I suppose, inherited by Jay Vine, who now is very well set for that particular prize, particularly given that in second place in that classification is a teammate of his, Marc Soler. Let's talk about Soler. Where do you start? Max Poole alluded in his interview to the fact that, well, Soler was, as I said the other day, he always is, he was extremely demonstrative, and I don't know how much of that is acting with Marc Soler. Some riders are just more demonstrative than others, something that's often lost in the kind of general mirth around Marc Soler is just how strong and talented he is. Let's not forget, this is a rider who at the start of his career was touted as the next great Spanish stage racer. He's turned into a great rider. He hasn't turned into the general classification rider that people hoped and expected, perhaps.
No, he won the Tour de l'Avenir. Let's not forget that. He comes from Catalonia, from Vilanova y la Geltrú, same town where the late Isaac Galvez, track rider's from. It's on the coast, just up the road from Barcelona, part of Spain that, obviously Catalonia, part of Spain that has given fantastic riders, and, you know, the oldest race in Spain as well, and the oldest stage race in Spain, and that is what race cycling is all about in Spain. We know that. And when any stage racer comes along, wins the Tour de l'Avenir at such a young age, and obviously that's a silly thing to say because you've got to be at a young age to win the Tour de l'Avenir, but wins the Tour de l'Avenir, everybody's under pressure to be the next Indurain, because cycling was Indurain. Cycling was then Contador. Who's the next Indurain? Who's the next Contador? That's all cycling fans are interested in, really, in Spain. The general public. I know that you've got people who will be listening to this podcast from Spain now, and I know there's crazy fans, especially where we are in Asturias.
big, big cycling region. But there's so much pressure on these guys. And I always, when I see some of Marc Soler's pronouncements, maybe the less fortunate ones that come out sometimes, and when I see how he rides, I always sort of try to remember and give him the benefit of the doubt in my mind when I'm frustrated by him. You know, as a fan of bike racing, thinking, why are you doing this now? Why are you wasting this energy? Whatever. You know, a lot of the colleagues I'm sat next to the commentary box are often frustrated watching him because of his immense talent. Mm. But I often think that, just imagine this pressure that this guy must have been under since he was a teenager to be the next big thing. I mean, he is a big thing. Let's be honest. He's got a tremendous palmarès. He hasn't won that many bike races, but when he wins, they are massive. And he's done it again today. And hat off to him, man.
I mean, he does have fantastic talent, but it's not a talent. His particular set of abilities are not necessarily catered for by the biggest races in the world.
Not on the team he's on now, because he has to do a job, doesn't he?
Yes, but I have serious, you know, I would have serious doubts about his ability to reinvent himself as a Grand Tour contender. I think the role he's in now is absolutely perfect. We heard Jay Vine earlier paying tribute to his selflessness. Just looking at, well, the way this Vuelta a España has panned out for that team. Obviously, on general classification, it's been a bit of a disaster for a team that came in with maybe six potential winners. But the way it has kind of fallen apart is almost all the sort of cards have fallen right into Marc Soler's hands, because they've been forced to ride in a way to try to salvage this Vuelta a España, which has suited him absolutely perfectly since stage 9. I mean, 121 kilometers in the break that day when Adam Yates won, 139 kilometers the next stage 10, 123 kilometers on stage 12, 169 stage 13, and 150 today. It hasn't been successful every day, but he certainly animated the race, and his will be, well, one could argue his is one of the most iconic faces of any bike race he participates in. But certainly the memory of Marc Soler hammering away either on the front of a peloton or off the front of a peloton will be one of the sort of enduring images of this Vuelta a España. Rob, before we conclude the part, just a word on Max Poole's performance today. I mentioned the string of near misses in this Vuelta a España. I suspect with the form he has, had his Vuelta not been compromised early on by crashing Portugal, he would have ridden a very good general classification in this race. He's ridden a very good Vuelta, not necessarily in the role that he expected.
And he's very close to his first pro win, isn't he? What is he now, just 21 years of age? Really has, in the last 18 months, come on the scene and looked in, well, just a tremendous talent. Now he sort of has the form to go with that. I'd love to see him give it one more try. There are stages, aren't there? But, you know, there's only so much gas in the tank, isn't there? It's difficult, certainly at that age.
And what a contrast with Marc Soler today. He was inscrutable and smooth, silky smooth on the bike. Looked very strong as well. And behind him, or in front of him eventually, you had Soler's head bobbing, his mouth open, sort of, well, with wearing this permanent grimace that we see Marc Soler wearing in, well, when he is, as I said earlier, where we have become accustomed to seeing him off the front of bike races.
And I almost fell for it again, because at that point in the stage you're thinking, oh well, this is Poole all the way. This is Poole's stage. Zana, it looked like he was sort of gritting his teeth, riding really well, but struggling to hold on to that smooth cadence, good style, class act, really, that Max Poole looked. And I, just like everybody, I'm sure, fell for it again in that, it's just Soler being Soler and he's going to come back and drop. But no, this time, it was a different story, wasn't it?
Rob, a moment ago, you mentioned Miguel Indurain. More about him in just a moment.
El encuentro del día. The meeting of the day.
Miguel entra en el Hotel Capitán. Gran expectación de público para ver, y Miguel Indurain, pues, que se retira de la Vuelta a España.
Ahí lo estamos viendo en estas imágenes desde el helicóptero.
Where are you going? What are you doing?
Yo me quedo por aquí. Fue un placer, señores.
Superman.
No,
well,
I am.
Actually,
but
maybe you're someone else. I'm looking at the sign up here.
Rob, I'm abandoning the Vuelta. It's been a long 2 weeks. I know it's your first day, but I'm abandoning, inspired by, well, the most famous abandonment ever in the Vuelta a España. And we're at, well, you tell the listeners where we are.
We're on the road between Arriondas and Cangas on the way to a big cathedral for a big man.
Big cathedral for a big man.
Covadonga.
Covadonga. And the cathedral, the big man being?
Big man, Big Mig.
Big Mig. So, yeah. This is where the road, well, it was the end of the road for Miguel Indurain. Hotel El Capitan, mentioned it in the podcast the other day, Rob, one of a series of, well, we talked about these sort of legendary hotels in cycling history, iconic hotel locations. El Capitan, 1996, Miguel Indurain, well, his dynasty had just ended in the Tour de France. He'd sort of been at loggerheads with his Banesto team for the whole season. He was only 32. The Vuelta a España that year, it wasn't going brilliantly for Indurain, but it wasn't going badly either.
He was still up there, wasn't he, in the GC?
He was third on general classification that morning. But, Rob, you were talking earlier in the car, you've ridden this climb, it's on the route today, the Fito, Mirador del Fito. Apparently, on the top of that climb, Miguel Indurain, he accosted his director sportif at the time, who was Eusebio Unzué, who was still the team manager of Movistar, and he said, "I got legs like two floorboards." Right. And tablas. Is that, would that be the translation?
I guess so.
Yeah. And Unzué said to him, "Well, Miguel, just ride to the hotel." Banesto was staying here at El Capitan. So I'm not even sure if he was dropped at that point, because we've just watched the coverage on TV and you see Big Mig in a fairly big group. Mm. And he just pulled to the side of the road, got off his bike. Apparently, his mechanic was waiting here. And he said, "This might be the end." And it was the end.
No, and we're surrounded by a sort of typical Asturian sight. There's mountains on either side. It's very green. You've got the huge corn fields across the road. And there's an old house that, when we were just watching those images again, is still there. It's abandoned. It's overgrown. The sort of living room's now possessed by a bit of a tree. And he gets off. He walks across the road. He's, as you say, shepherded there. And there's a bit of a media scrum. They're looking down from the helicopter.
A media scrum for us.
Not for us, no.
Apparently,
we're not
though,
that important yet.
Apparently, though, we should just go inside, because I think there is one picture of him in here. He returned here, and apparently he does return. Whenever he's in the area, he does return. And there should be somewhere a plastic sign saying something along the lines of, "Well, Miguel Indurain stopped cycling here." Just walking through the front door now, I think we saw a lady a minute ago, the receptionist. Should we ask them, Rob?
Sí.
Hola, buena.
Estamos trabajando en la vuelta.
Sí.
Y obviamente este es el famoso sitio donde Indurain abandonó la vuelta.
El tema fue memorable.
Sí. Sí. ¿Estaba usted?
Aquí, en el hotel, no. Estaba en Cangas de Onís.
Vale.
Pero vamos. Ni idea, pero bueno, es que son deportistas de fama mundial. Quiero decir, él, Rafael Nadal, Fernando Alonso, son deportistas, en este caso españoles, que...
Uno de los más famosos de la historia.
Vamos, que son históricos.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Well, Rob, that was an unconventional Encuentro del Día. I don't know whether the subject was the ghost of Miguel Indurain, who's still alive, fortunately, whether it was El Capitan, whether it was the staff at El Capitan.
Maybe it was with the photograph that was guarded under padlock.
Oh, yes.
She had to open the padlock just to let us look at it in a sort of sideboard cabinet sort of thing.
And the victims, we will anoint the two very kind, well, gentleman and lady, we'll anoint them the victims of our Encuentro del Día. They were slightly aggrieved is maybe the wrong word. They were slightly saddened that, well, they said that people who visited the hotel nowadays showed a lot less
interest in what had occurred there than maybe was the case sort of 10, 15 years ago. There were a lot of people who would come to sort of pay their respects to this great moment, this very dramatic moment. We heard the commentary a few moments ago, Indurain getting off in the Vuelta a España, and there aren't quite as many people that pay pilgrimage now.
No, do you know what it was? It was a really sort of slightly polite version of the youth of today.
Yes.
It was basically bemoaning the fact that young people today who come and stay, because I think they have a lot of sort of school trip groups who come up here, you know, down where the hotel is, it's really close to a big area for canoeing and outdoor kayaking, outdoorsy stuff, and you get a lot of school trips coming up here. And he was saying, well, none of them know, none of them are interested. And it's obviously their prized possession, this photograph, and this happening kept behind the sort of lock and key. And you know, I think they were slightly disappointed that it's only idiots like us who turn up on days like these to talk about it.
I do feel that they need to build more of a shrine, maybe. Anyway, that was very entertaining. And Rob, I talked a few days ago about one day this week, I am going to come up with a definitive list of these iconic cycling hotels, whether it be the Hotel Touring in Madonna di Campiglio or the Hotel Excelsior in Savona, which we visited in the Giro d'Italia. But I think I could probably come up with a list of at least 5, maybe even 10. Rob, it's that time in the podcast where we talk about what we had for dinner yesterday and we talk about what the riders have on the menu tomorrow.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Rob, you hadn't joined me yet. You were staying up the road in Gijón. I was staying in Avilés last night, and of course, I had to sample some of the local Asturian. Delicacies is the wrong word when it comes to Asturian food, because it ain't very delicate, is it, Rob?
I have to be very careful what I say on this podcast, because I'll have a certain listener at home who's very proud of Asturian cuisine, and despite the fact we speak in Spanish, I know speaks better English than I do because she lived there for a long time. So I have to be very careful and very diplomatic what I say. I will just say that Asturian cuisine is very hearty. And there are massive, massive portions with every single thing you order.
If I was ever to be drawn into, goaded into something that, well, could be referred to as a food fight, I think I would want Asturian food as my weaponry.
Messy as well, isn't it? Lots of beans.
You could do a lot of damage with a cachopo. If you whack someone over the head with a cachopo, explain what cachopo is, Rob.
Cachopo is the sort of prized delicacy. I know that you didn't want to use that word, but it is, isn't it?
What does it consist of?
It's got meat, it's got cheese, it can have things like mushrooms, and it's sort of bound together in breadcrumbs. Banged. It is actually beaten when they beat it. They beat it, and then, you know, do they fry it as well?
So, Rob, last night I was with one of our colleagues at dinner, and I ordered, well, for me, the cachopo, because it is typical and it's a bit of a tradition to have it when we come to Asturias. I either have the fabada, the bean and meat soup, or
les favis, as they call it here, les favis.
Or cachopo. And is it a very common thing to, well, is the cachopo one sees on a menu always intended to be shared? Because it was so humongous. It was the size of a small continent. Is one always supposed to share this?
No, sharing food is a big thing, though. I mean, whenever most people go out here, I think several things are ordered and everybody eats a little bit of everything. But no, I mean, a cachopo is one meal. You and I have talked about the portions in this part of the world several times before. And yeah, whatever you order, it is big.
Yeah, when they talk about sharing plates here, it's not that tippy-tappy.
It's not tippy-tappy, no.
Little
no.
kind of...
It's a bit cheaper than the tippy-tappy plates as well.
Yeah, considerably. Rob, I said we were going to tell people what's on the menu tomorrow. Let's do that now, please.
So tomorrow's stage takes us into Cantabria. It's a start and finish in Cantabria, one of the many comunidad autónoma in Spain. The comunidades autónomas, I should say, in Spain. Beginning in Arnuero and then heading inland, heading south into the hills. There's two second category climbs back to back within around 20 kilometres of each other. They come just before the halfway point in the stage, and then there's a big downhill, lumps and bumps all the way to the regional capital, which is Santander on the coast. I know it's a place close to your heart because of El Gato coming from there and because of a señor Severiano Ballesteros coming from down there.
Yes, Rob. And in fact, we are going through Severiano Ballesteros' birthplace in Pedreña tomorrow at some point on the route. I was just trying to bring up, Rob, my proudest moment as a journalist was the interview I did with Señor Ballesteros in around about 2004 for the official guide of the Tour de France. He was a big fan of cycling, a cyclist himself. He had been to the Tour de France. He was friends with Miguel Indurain and had been sort of Indurain's guest of honour a couple of times at the Tour de France. And I spent a cracking half an hour on the phone to Seve talking about all things cycling.
Well, the cycling tomorrow will see 2,300 metres of climbing over 141 kilometres. And again, as I said, finishing in Santander.
Rob, I think it's about time we headed... Well, we undertook the journey that Ben O'Connor has undertaken already twice today. No, that's... Yeah, he went down twice.
He's been
once
down
by,
twice,
once,
yeah.
Once by bike, once by car. And we head down the mountain.
I can tell you as well, the fines are out.
Go on.
And they are lofty. Hefty. There's a few Swiss francs gone the way of the UCI this evening.
Gone the way of the UCI? Gone the way of Ben O'Connor from the UCI?
Well, no, because Ben O'Connor and the team are paying it to
the UCI. Sorry. Yeah, I see what you mean. Did you say a thousand
Swiss is what's just popped francs. Up on WhatsApp. Having seen it with my own eyes, one of the commentators in our group has just said that it's 1,000 Swiss for the
delay. Do we have the actual wording? It's delay of the ceremony.
If you give me two seconds, start saying goodbye while I pull this up.
Because I wonder what one gets fined for skiving off, the sacking off the ceremony.
See, bear with
because
me, I'm scrolling.
At one
scrolling,
point,
doom
that
scrolling.
That may have been an option. Did you get kicked out of the race for sacking
here
off?
Here we go. So, Article 2.12007-1.3, failing to attend official ceremonies or failing to respect the 10-minute deadline after the rider crosses the finish line, number 51, O'Connor, Ben, Decathlon, Azur des Alpes Mondial, fine of 1,000 Swiss francs,
we'll investigate.
20 UCI points in the rankings, and the forfeiture of prizes.
Well, one thing I must say, one footnote to that is that if the penalty would have been the same, effectively, 1,000 Swiss francs for sacking it off, all credit to Ben O'Connor
for
very respectfully coming all the way up the mountain again when he wasn't happy and he wasted a lot of time and actually going through with it.
Certainly, that's a very nice way of looking at it as well.
Rob, we never skive, we never sack anything off. We'll be back tomorrow.
We will be.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Bugs crashing your PAX party? Whether they've got paws or sneakers, your PAX deserves a home that's protected from pests. That's where Wonderside comes in. Plant-powered protection made with steam-distilled natural essential oils that actually work. It kills and repels fleas, ticks, mosquitoes, and ants without questionable ingredients or overpowering smells. Safe to use around kids and pets when used as directed. Lab-proven to work fast. and proudly made in the USA. We offer sprays for pets, people, homes, and yards. Plus, spot-on treatments, colors, and even shampoos. Whatever your pack needs, we've got it covered. Founded by a pet parent looking for a better way to protect her dog, Luna, Wonderside's now protected over 21 million lives and counting. You might have even seen us on Shark Tank. Go to Wonderside.com and use code WONDER20 for 20% off your first order. That's WONDER20 at Wonderside.com. Wonderside, protect your pack with plant-powered Wonderside today.